Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2015. Lecture 2, delivered on January 15, 2015. The title of this lecture is First Principles of Finance.
Today, First Principles of Finance. And it's sort of like there's a central theme, but it doesn't sound like there is. I go through a couple of different topics, getting you ready for deeper learning later, but there are some important first principles of finance that I have to get through with you in this first lecture. And let me mute this. I will be writing on the board here a little bit. But let me mute that for the time, writing on the overhead projector here. But let me start with a couple of kind of basic questions, and I'll try to find some new people to pick on this time. You got any money in your pocket?
No.
You know?
No cash.
So I can't get $10?
No.
Okay. You. $10?
I have some money, yeah.
$10 in your pocket?
I have.
Really?
Yeah.
You actually know how much? I have to look to see. You know.
I just pulled it out.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, I mean, I just check to see if I've got enough to walk into the restaurant and all that kind of stuff. Here's the deal, though. Now, you give me I could borrow $10 from you, okay? In that situation, at that timing level, you are what we call a surplus economic agent. A surplus economic agent. You have a surplus of money. You're not going to use all 40 of that right away, are you?
Tonight, probably, yeah.
It's going to take that much to find a girlfriend, right? That was harsh. No, it'll only take about 100 I'd get if I were you. Look, but in this very short term, he is a surplus economic agent. He could hook me up with $10 for a couple hours, maybe a day or two. Okay, now, at the same time, though, do you have enough money to buy a house?
Not even close.
Not even close. Okay. Now, your dream is to get yourself a double-wide trailer, because you married a double-wide woman, on the south side of Decatur, and there's going to have to be enough room in there because she, from another marriage, she has three kids. And, of course, her brother is probably going to move in, too. And you're going to need to have the money for that dream double-wide trailer. But you don't have it. So in a need like that, he is a deficit economic unit. And one of the big, big things in finance is what we call financial intermediation. Financial intermediation is matching surplus economic units with deficit economic units. But notice there's something interesting it's not just how much money you have, how much money I need. It's also a matter of the amount of money. If I asked you for $1,000 for a couple hours, you wouldn't have it. So in this intermediation, there has to be a matching that recognizes the amount of money. We use the term level. So that's the first thing in financial intermediation. We're matching surplus and deficit economic units by level. And then there's also this other thing, timing. Okay, you might be able to hook me up with $10 for 2 hours, but for a day, that would... No, man, I need it tonight. So, in other words, there's the timing. Is he a surplus unit that has the timing need that matches my... the timing that matches my need? So timing will be part of it too. But there's even a third factor involved too. You, madam, look like a very conservative person. You're not the kind of wild and... Actually, you do look like... Anyway. You're looking at me like, really? Try it, Buster. Okay, but let's say you're a very conservative investor. Now, you might put your money into something that is very safe. But if I were to come to you with some wild scheme that had a very low chance of success, but, you know, it might work, you're a surplus economic unit, I'm a deficit economic unit, but you're going to say, get away from me, you weirdo, which you're probably saying anyway right now. It's like, you're going fetal on me. I know, it's the breath, isn't it? And the demeanor. But look, you see, she would be unwilling to take that level of risk. But there are others who would be willing to take that level of risk. They're, early in your lives, you are going to probably be more willing to take on risky investments than you would later. Because right now, you could recover from getting an ass bath. That's a technical term. But later on, when you're like 50 years old and you're becoming decrepit and you're thinking about your Metamucil and your fixed income, you don't want to take chances, you would be a much lower risk kind of surplus economic. You might have a lot of money, but you're not going to throw it away. Younger in your life, you would be more likely to take on more risk in your investments because, for one thing, you're a little wild and crazy, you know, with that neckbeard thing going on there. And and you're also more willing, just because, as I said, you would have more time to come back from a raw deal than if you were older, where you couldn't come back from that kind of a disaster. So in other words, the three factors in matching surplus and deficit economic units are level, the amount, the timing, when the cash flows will go back and forth, and the risk. Level, timing, and risk. Now, here's one of those places where the book and I disagree. Do you recall, right off the top of your head, who's right? Yeah. Bingo! There you go. Even if you are wearing a Patriots shirt. look, the book says that this involves financial institutions. Not necessarily. There are many, many financial intermediations that happen all the time that there's no financial institution involved. Now, certainly they are involved in some, and they're a critical, massively critical part of our financial system, but that doesn't mean that all financial intermediations occur through financial institutions. I'm going to borrow money from you, or you're going to borrow money from me. Have you ever borrowed money from your dad? Yeah. I mean, he's not a financial institution. He might feel like it all of the times you go to ask him for money, but he's not. But he's still a surplus economic unit. You're a deficit economic unit. There's a matching on level, timing, and risk. So it is financial intermediation. No financial institution involved. That's one of those things when the book is kind of biasing towards this official world that's not always really there. And in real finance, we have to recognize, yeah, the official world, the official numbers, the official rules are always what we have to teach, but we also have to recognize that that unofficial world is out there. The black markets, the gray markets, the unspoken markets. And so we have to recognize, yeah, there's more to this financial intermediation than just financial institutions acting as the intermediaries. So just keep that in mind. When I ask it on an exam, hint, hint, in the definition, what is financial intermediation? Remember, I want one sentence, complete and perfect. And it'll say financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units with respect to level, timing, and risk. That's all you have to say for an essay question of mine. You say more than that, you risk a couple of things. One is, you're going to piss me off, and if you go way around the barn to get to the outhouse, I have a bullshit stamp. This is what I'm trying to teach you about business. Say what you have to say. Show me that you know your subject well enough that you don't need to write me some term paper to give me an answer. That makes you a stronger person in a business environment than the person who thinks that there's some wild, long definition. Financial intermediation is the matching of surplus and deficit economic units using level with regard to level, timing, and risk, or something along that line. Don't be creative. We're business people. We have no creativity in us whatsoever. We leave that to the marketing people if they ever get jobs. Oh, that was harsh. Okay, that's the first thing, okay? Now, let's get back to something that is a little bit deeper. Oh, yeah, Denny's tonight. Oh, that's Jack. Yeah. Woman, I got a dollar. And I'd like you to go up to the top. I'll show you how to get up there to the very top of the College of Business. And there's a way that we can get out on the roof. And I'd like you to get out there and jump. And I will give you this dollar if you do so. The hell, man? This is a dollar. See, and it's even, I printed this. I got this one right there. There you go. It's a dollar. I mean, a dollar is, that's, you know, like a dollar. What is it? Are you one of those people, no, I don't want no money in this world. Risk, you'll bounce. I mean, for God's sake. I mean, you know, there's snow on the ground. I mean, that'll catch your fall. Squirrel might be under there. That'll, you know, help soften the blow a little bit. Here, you see, that's right. Okay, suppose I said if you just reach across this young man, there's a risk there, too, that he'll, you know, I've seen Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I know what happens when those guys, you know, their face turns monsters. Supernatural, your eyes turn black, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Would you reach across and take the dollars that way? Not as much risk, because we know damn well he's... I mean, look, is he really supernatural material? I mean, can he be Sam and Dean? No, I don't think so. Could you even be, you know, Buffy's...
I can try.
Easy, boy. You see, there's the point, is that you would be willing to make money, but what you do has to be commensurate with the risk involved. So if I were to say, I'll give you a dollar if you will stand on a train track when a train is coming, you're not, and you have to wait until 2 seconds before the train is on you to jump, for a dollar, you'd say no. But if I offered you $1 million to do it, the $1 million would run on the other side of that train track, you might actually do it, risking the chance that the train is going to hit you, ding, 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 and then we're going to have to clean you off the cattle scooper on the front with a spatula. You see, risk drives our decision-making. Risk drives. Here is the first. The first principle of finance. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And I'm saying expected because you don't know whether you will win or lose. If you invest in a risky stock, you are doing so not because you love risk, it's because you expect something good out of it. If nothing good is going to come out of it, you're not going to be stupid, unless you're one of those people who does those movies, Jackass movies or something like that, or wants to be on YouTube. But even there, have you ever watched those YouTubes where people try to get themselves killed? Well, the reason they're doing it, they wouldn't do it if they didn't expect some big return out of it. It's not necessarily money. In finance, we always bring it down to dollars and cents. We liquidate the value of the risk taken. But at the same time, you're never going to do anything that is risky without expecting something in return for it. The greater the risk, the greater the expected return. And make sure you do that. If I ask this as an essay question, or if that's in a multiple choice, make sure you see or write that word expected, because we don't know what's going to happen next. You could be hit by a meteor tonight. You don't know whether you're going to live or not through the night. Okay, here's another one. Who else? Okay. Have you ever broken a speed limit?
Once or twice.
You lie. You drive like a blind trout all the time. I've seen you drive. I don't know, blind trout driving. Anyway, think about it. Why? You could get a ticket doing that. So if you're driving down this highway and you're hitting the accelerator, you're not doing that if you know there's a cop up ahead, right? If you saw a policeman up ahead, you'd have a halo around your head, and you'd be looking just like Jesus. But if that cop isn't there, you are going to assess the risk as lower, and therefore you are willing to take that risk because there's an expected return in it. You're going to get to your destination faster. You're going to see if your car can actually hit warp speed and all that kind of stuff and scare the crap out of the people in the back of the car when you get to 130 miles an hour. You see, there's the thing is, you got to have something come out of it. You're not going to take risk in finance, in every aspect of finance. Everything is driven by the risk expected return relationship, by the risk expected return relationship. That's what drives every decision making aspect. And that, by the way, let me say something here. That's one of the things that has become corrupted in our financial system. You might have, I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but we have this massive, massive problem with these things called derivatives, which are essentially, they're essentially a package of risk. You take something that is risky, and then you write a financial instrument that represents the risk. And then you sell that to someone who likes that risk. And then that someone might decide to put that risk along with some other risks to create a new derivative and sell that to someone else. And then that someone else decides to sell it to someone else with some other risks in it. And after a chain of those kinds of things, you've got this massive risk package out there spinning around in space. And we don't, in many cases, we can't even track it back to where the real asset was that started it. How much money are we talking about in derivatives now? Well, let's start with the financial apocalypse. At that point, the notional value of toxic derivatives that were crashing all over the place at the boundary of the near apocalypse in September of 2008 was $62 trillion. But you see, there was no one really had the risk, so there was no fear. And that's the problem, is when you decouple risk from expected return, you have corrupted one of the driving factors that makes people behave themselves in financial markets. So, did we reform the system? No. How much in notional derivatives is out there right now spinning around? Remember I said 62 trillion? 63 trillion. Right now, the estimates that I'm seeing that are kind of in the ballpark of what I've calculated myself, $319 trillion in notional value in derivatives. And those risks, who has the risk anymore? Because we don't even know where the risk is attached. That's one of the problems when you separate risk from expected return. Why are you here?
You're a great professor.
Oh, damn. I mean, my heart warm, my pants damp. Thank you. Why? I mean, you could get a job. You could work at Walmart. Hell, with your looks, you could work at Aldi's. Chippendale. Nah, not even close. Okay. Don't you see the risk? I can't promise you a job. I can't promise you a job when you get out of here. Truth of the matter is, we don't have a perfect placement rate on people who get degrees here. You might be back in your parents' basement eating Cheetos, playing World of Warcraft, or something like that. No guarantee, but you have an expectation, and the risk is attached to the expectation. You know damn well this is risky. At the same time, you also know that, I mean, God, there have even been classes where people come in and shot people. That's a risk in this class. I mean, there's a clean shot, elevated position. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hold you guys up in front of me. Bullet sponge? I think so. But you understand that there is an expectation of gain, but there is a risk involved in this. You're not promised anything out of this, but you do know that there is a good possibility that you'll get something better than Aldi's for a job when you finish here. That's that attachment, and that is what drives our decision-making in every aspect of our lives. We have a risk-return relationship. And like I said, interestingly enough, and I'm going to tell you this now, I can look at a person right now, and I can say, okay, you are quite risk-averse. I would bet that. And why do I know that? Not because I know you, but because actually most people are. Even younger people are actually quite risk-averse. It's only a very special class of people who really like risk, and they're willing to buy it from other people and absorb it. Have you ever known anyone in your life that was just an absolutely crazy mofo? I mean, unfortunately, I've met more than my share of them, and that's why I'm old before my time. But there are people who do have that. There are companies. That's their specialty, is to absorb insane risk. That's what insurance companies do. You pay them money so that you don't have to bear the risk. They bear the risk because that is, they're in the business of absorbing risk for a fee. Okay? So you understand that normally most people and most companies are risk-averse. They avoid risk, and they try to mitigate, minimize risk. And that's the next important principle. When I use the word risk, I'm actually talking about two kinds of risk. Two kinds of risk. And I'll start with This is going to be a touchy subject, so I've got to find someone that is going to be really of good humor. Nope, not in this class. Oh, I got to get closer to see if it's true. It is. Acne. Zits. That is risk that... Think of acne as risk that can be made to go away. You can use Clearasil. You can use a shaver. You can use a sandblaster. Or you can just wait and it'll finally disappear on its own. But I'm going to tell you a secret. You have nodules in your bowel. You have some cancer cells underneath your lung. You have some weird virus swirling around, replicating itself, doing the wild thing in your stomach that's going to give you diarrhea tonight. That is inside of him. It is in his system. It can't be removed. It's part of him. Really, it can't. Well, surgery, we'll see. Yeah. The two kinds of risk are the risk that you don't need to have. No one is going to give you anything. You should not expect a return for taking risks that you could get rid of. You don't need that risk. You can get rid of that risk. So there is going to be no financial market that will give you any kind of a chance of a return for taking on that risk. We call that non-systematic risk. Non-systematic risk is risk that can be removed. Another term for this is what is called diversifiable risk. And you'll see what that means here in a little while. Non-systematic or diversifiable risk is risk for which you should not expect any return whatsoever because you can get rid of that risk. And no one is going to give you a penny for taking that risk. But then there is that other risk that is in the system. We call that systematic risk. It is risk that you can't remove. You cannot mitigate it. You cannot reduce it. Systematic risk. The other term for that is non-diversifiable risk. Non-diversifiable risk. Okay. There. Oh, goody. I don't have any paper. Do I have any paper? What kind of a classroom doesn't even have markers, doesn't have paper? Boy, that just irritates the hell out of me. Paper. Is this anybody's cup? Ew. Sweet. Well, I might have to hold off on this if I can't find a piece of paper. But that's a little ways. I was just getting it set up anyway. Maybe I'll find a piece of paper here in a minute or two. You got a piece of paper? I'm not going to give you any. Well, I'll give you a point, a half a point. Oh, don't patronize me. Of course I have a pencil. Don't talk down to me like that. Hang on here. I'm going to show you something here. If I can find it. Okay, if I can get this to actually work here. Turn on the lamp. Okay, how the hell do you turn this on? It's making noises. Okay, here, I'm going to tell you. We're going to start with your life. Okay? Your life. These are medical costs on the vertical axis. And on the horizontal axis is time. Now, when you were born, you were a pretty sickly baby. I mean, colic, diarrhea. And the costs of your medical care were pretty high, and they got higher. And then you began to get a little bit healthier, and then you had that little bout as a toddler with illness. Things were okay for a few years, and then you learned how to ride a bicycle, and then a skateboard. And you got into your adolescent years, and there were a few issues there. The alcohol, that funny stuff that was on those brown tabs. Then that stuff that your friends had this funny name for it, they called it the good shit. You were in rehab. And then you entered your early 20s. And that's something we do know about people. I don't know if you've gotten there yet. Do you remember being sick as a kid and you're not as sick as often now? You begin to get a little healthier. You begin to develop what we call the herd immunities in your 20s. And you're pretty darn healthy there for some years. And your medical costs are going down. And then you get into your 30s. You have a couple of little things, a couple of nodules in your throat. And they're removed and some things like this. Then you get diabetes and a heart attack. And then there's that Viagra. Then your bladder starts dripping. And then you get some other more serious long-term medical issues as your life goes on. Into your 60s and then your 70s. And then there's another cancer. And then, thank God, you die. Okay. Now, let's pick up with you, woman. Born about the same time. Oh, you were just such a healthy baby. I mean, there was nothing wrong with you at all. I mean, you were just a joy. I mean, sure, that there was those weird things where your head would turn completely around in the middle of the night, but, you know. And you were in good shape. And you had a couple of things in your early childhood. And then everything was okay. And then you found out what the word boys means. And then there was that whole emo thing. Have you ever heard about the emo pizza? Yeah, it cuts itself. Okay, I'll shut up. Then there was that major bout. You had a cancer. You got through that. Then you had another cancer scare. You got diabetes in your 40s, but you kept rolling. You felt good, but, you know, you had medicines you had to take. And then there was that crazy episode, and you got through that with aplomb. But you had high blood pressure going into your 60s. You had arthritis, and you lived longer than the guy did. But you did have illnesses, and getting into your 80s, you had these. Now, what I'm trying to do is show you something here. These two people's medical costs were not perfectly correlated. So to a certain extent, they actually canceled each other out. If I put more and more people into this of different ages, you would have old people in here in their high-cost years, young people in here in their low-cost years. You would have all these different people partially canceling each other out. And if you put enough people into a system like that, all of these random ups and downs that are unpredictable. I don't know when you're going to go through your middle-age, midlife crisis and do something stupid. I don't know when you are going to go into your crazy years either, or your sick years. But I don't have to. If there are enough people built in to this chart, they will ultimately cancel each other's randomness out, and what you'll have instead is a level of cost that is predictable from the herd. That is the systematic risk. I don't have to bear, as an insurance company, the non-systematic, the random risk of each individual, and that means that I know how much I'm going to pay out to the herd, which means that no one in the herd who is insured will ever have a financial crisis. Even if you get a cancer, you're in the herd and I'm insuring you, you don't have to worry about financial ruin. Because when you're having the cancer, I've got people who are healthy as hell paying the premiums. And the more people you have in that, the more of that diversifiable, that non-systematic, that unnecessary risk goes away. And all that is left is the hum of the herd. You've seen this in your lives. I'm almost positive you've seen this. This is what drives stock investing. And I'm going to talk about that here in a minute. But you, sir, sing for me. Okay, let's do something together. Let's do something romantic. A Barry Manilow tune. And I'm ready to take a chance. Go, work it, boy. I was afraid you were going to do that. No, have you ever heard, everyone in this room, it might be a few who are not, but most of us in this room, we are terrible singers. We suck as singers. But if we put us all together as a choir, suddenly, we sound pretty darn good. All that, you don't even sing. It sounds more like yodeling. That nasal thing, God. But if we put us all together, the random awfulness of each of us cancels out, and we have the herd and that underlying hum of all of these people together. This is how financial markets work. This is how risk works. Why would I want to cover someone who refuses to join in and get rid of that random, dangerous volatility? Why would I do that when I can say, just insure, and then you are no longer exposed? I don't have to worry about you getting cancer and looking for welfare if you are part of the system. And that's why there is an importance in making sure that we have health care insurance that is affordable, so that there really is a problem with affordability. You get everyone into the herd and into the insurance pool, and then all that randomness, all the risk to individuals getting ruined is gone. This is what I mean by that systematic risk thing. Here's how it works in stock markets. If you invest in, I'm going to show you something here. Yes, please. Well, I will in a minute here. But for this one, I'll just do it on the back of this one. This is called the Mr. T chart. On this axis is pity. On this axis is fool. And the more the fool, the more the pity. I pity the fool who wants to invest in one stock, because you are going to have insane variability that you don't have to have if you invest in more than one stock, where their individual ups and downs partially cancel each other out. So what that means, and now, yes, that piece of paper, please. So what that means is that when you are building a portfolio of stocks, if you have just one stock in your portfolio, the amount of risk that you are bearing with one stock is ridiculous, because most of that risk is peculiar to that stock. It is non-systematic. It is diversifiable. You put another stock into your portfolio that isn't perfectly correlated with its volatility, and you reduce the risk of the portfolio. You put in a couple more and a couple more, and you keep going. And ultimately, if you were able to put all of the stocks of the economy into your portfolio, weighted by how much each of these companies contributes to the economy, you would come down to a risk level here. In other words, as the number of stocks in your portfolio expands, your risk of the portfolio asymptotically approaches some level. That is the risk of the system, the systematic risk. The systematic risk is this risk that you cannot diversify away. But look at all of the risk that you can get rid of, that you can diversify away. That's why when you get these shows for finance, finance shows, well, I'm recommending that people buy this stock. That is the stupidest recommendation on earth, because all you're recommending they do is get their butts kicked with all that risk that no one's going to reward them for that. And then, of course, you'll have this person, well, this guy invested in one stock and he made $1 billion. Well, you'll never see them take on all the people who did the same thing, a million people who got their butts kicked doing that. Today, we're interviewing another person who was too stupid to diversify his portfolio. They won't do that to you. They're in the business of trying to hawk bad investing on you. Diversify. Because no market is going to reward you for taking on all that risk that you could avoid. So that's where we get this term diversifiable risk. So really, the rule is the greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. The greater the non-diversifiable risk, the greater the expected return. Understand how important that is in our world. You are not going to be rewarded for being stupid. In financial markets, more power to you if you just want to buy one kind of stock, one company stock, over and over and over again. Yeah, you might make some money on it, but the amount of risk that you're going to take to do that is ridiculous. That's another point that should be made about these financial programs and all these news articles. This fund manager was the top ranking in terms of how much return he made on his portfolio. This fund manager. Who cares? The question would be, what level of non-diversifiable risk did he take to do that? You, sir, might be a fund manager. You've got a 5% return on your portfolio that you're managing. This young man might have a 40% return. I don't really care. What I really want to know is how much non-diversifiable risk were you exposing your people to, and how much non-diversifiable risk were you exposing your people to. I can double well guarantee you that you were taking on massive risk. Maybe your good manager was all non-diversifiable risk, but there's no glory in having a massively high return on your portfolio. That's just you wanted to take on a lot more risk. Have you ever thought about being a soldier?
No.
I could see you being a soldier of fortune. There are companies that pay incredibly high money for people like you to go to very dangerous places and fight in very, very nasty ways. Okay? You want to do that?
No.
I understand. I know, right? That's okay. Now, this guy, guts and glory and that whole thing, kill them all, let God sort them out. Oops, there's a bullet in me. I don't have time to bleed. I'm Arnold Schwarzenegger and all that kind of stuff. I'm learning how to talk like Sylvester Stallone. Oh, look at me. Okay. But that doesn't mean that he is a better person than you are. He's going to make more money because they'll pay him, Blackwater will pay you $400,000 a year to drive trucks and carry really cool weaponry. You're going to work for Megacorp International and sit in a cubicle and make $60,000 a year, but you are going to take on a lot more risk. Even if you are taking on intelligent risk, you're mitigating all the risks, you're still in a higher risk industry. No glory because you make more money. You're just a crazy mofo. You understand how we think in the business world. Great if you want to make lots and lots of money. There are a lot of people who just want to live their lives, and that's one of the things in investing too. If you want to make a lot of money in the investment world, yeah, you can, but you're going to have to recognize you've got to take on a lot of risk. Even after you've shaken out all of the non-systematic risk, you're still going to have to take on a lot of risk. A lot of people really don't want to do that. They want to live longer, they want to have some money and all that kind of stuff to go into their retirement. So understand that about this. And that's it kind of goes on. I beat that thing to death, but it's an important thing. Now I'm going to take you a little bit into the world of specific financial instruments, financial securities, to give you another view on risk. Before I do that, I do want to make one quick mention of something here. Yeah.
Are we going to be drawing charts on your
test? Oh, if you draw charts on my test, I will shoot you. Realistically, know something. I taught economics for many, many years, and I still do. And there's this obsession in economics, I don't know if you've noticed it, but of these pictures of supply and demand graphs and all that kind of stuff, ISLMs if you've taken the higher level. You remember that? You know what? A graph is actually a crutch to the extent that you should be able to explain. The graph is just a way of illustrating, but actually oftentimes many people really aren't graph-oriented in the way they learn and the way they best visualize and think about things. So if you come down to the point where you're drawing me a graph, that probably means you're Rain Man. I'm not impressed, okay? If you can't say it to me in words, you know, in academic language, don't talk to me, you know, or something like that. But at the same time, if you can't just explain it to me in plain language, you're probably not going to be able to explain it to the people who really need you to explain things to them when you get out there. If you're trying to sell investments to a couple, you whip out a bunch of charts, here you go, you know, you're shutting them off. You explain to people that you're the manager, all right, we're going to look at these charts and that'll tell you what I want you to know. You're missing the point. So no, I really hope you don't get that desperate on things. No, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's one of the things that I see. You know, sometimes we do these just as an illustration, but notice how I pull away from it and I just start talking again once I've done that, because that was just like a scaffolding for the building. Once that's over with, I can take the scaffolding off, and you know what I've got? A great casino. You know what? Last semester, I actually stepped on this cord once. I nearly tore it. Okay, here we go. Listen, risk. In our world, we have to go beyond using words. And charts sometimes, yeah. But we also need to be able to measure things. And mostly, the reason we have to measure things is so that we can compare them to other things. Wait a minute. That was dinner yesterday. We have to measure things so that we can compare them to other things in some kind of a quantitative way. So we can say, well, it's cold outside. Well, how cold is it? It's damn cold. Is it colder than it was yesterday? Well, I think so. It's better if we have some numbers that we can put on things for measurements relative to each other. And this is the way it is with risk. Now, we can use a lot of words to describe risk. Words like yeehaw, or oh my God, or why the hell am I in this car with a maniac, or something like this. But it's better if we have measurements of risk. And I'm going to show you different measurements of risk, some you've probably never even heard of. And some you've seen, but you probably didn't know that they are actually risk measurements. So that is the context in which I begin this part of the lecture. In the world of finance, there are essentially two ways. Okay. There are three ways that you can raise money for a business. You can borrow money. That's called debt. The thing about debt is that you have to pay your bills before you can give the owners a dime. Debt has the prior claim on cash flows. Now, you don't always have to pay off all your debt. You make arrangements, but you have to pay your debts in a timely manner before the owners can have any money. Now, the ownership, you could raise money by selling stock. That would mean that you are selling ownership shares. There are two basic kinds, common stock and preferred stock. So you can raise money through debt, or you can raise money through equity. There is, of course, one other way that you can raise money, but it's actually a subset of one of the two that I just gave you. Is there another way that a company can raise money besides borrowing money or selling stock? Huh? Oh, sweet. I know, right? No, but it's not going to happen. Maybe it will. No, it's not for me. unless I can get someone else to be the front person for the company. There is another way. How about trying to earn money by selling products at a profit? Yeah, I know, right? Crazy idea. But actually, that is a subset of the equity. You see, because if I make money at the bottom line, I have all, that would mean that I've already paid my bills, my debt, as it was due, which means that after that, what's there at the bottom line is the residual claim of the shareholders. So that is actually a kind of equity too. That profit after you've paid your debts that are due in the period, that's a kind of equity too. But so basically, there is debt and equity. Debt means you're borrowing money. Equity means that you are either bringing in new owners or you are making money for the owners that already exist.
Did you say the third one was profit?
Say it.
Did you say the third one was
profit? Basically profit. You know, because if you remember your accounting class, I know most of you have probably tried to go through some therapy to get past that time in your lives. I should not make fun of accountants. Yes, I should, but sometimes someone takes something I say back. So I'm not going to make fun of any accountants today. Do you know why accountants walk in groups of three? One reads, one writes, and the other keeps an eye on the two intellectuals. So, okay. I'm not going to say anything more bad about accountants. I won't. What do you got when you got a half busload of accountants going off a mountain? A waste of half the seats. Oh, sorry. Yep, you said something bad about accountants, and then they'll come in and chew on my ankle. Look, we're going to talk about this in an accounting sense, but really there's an economic sense behind it. You got your revenues, what you take in, and then you got your costs. Now, among those costs, every cost you have is really a debt. Your utility bill is a debt that you owe to the utility companies. Your we borrowed money on a short-term basis. It's due in a year. Well, we're going to pay a payment on that. That kind of intermediate kind of debt we call notes. Bills are anything that's due within a year. Notes are anything that's due between a year and 7 years, I'm sorry. And then the long stuff is called bonds. James Bond. No, bonds. Anything that's over 7 years in length. So if you're paying those, you've paid them off or you've made your payments in a timely manner, those are in the costs. So when you've got your revenues minus your costs is your profit, okay, there you go. What's the bottom line? You've satisfied the prior claim for the current period. That's the debt holders. And so whatever's there at the bottom line is available to the shareholders. That's the residual claim. The owners get the residual claim. They get whatever's left after the debt holders have been satisfied. Now, that residual claim, usually in a corporation, there are two things that they can do. The residual claim, they can either pay out in dividends and or they can plow some of that back into the company to raise the stock price if they invest it well. And I'll get into that in more detail in the lectures to come. But one of the things you'll see about the way I teach, I throw things at you and then I pull them back in and then I bring them up again later. It's sort of like a layering effect. And it works pretty well because then you're not totally shocked when I throw something at you at its highest level because you already know a little bit about it. But in this case, what we're going to talk about is a corporate debt versus consumer debt, very quickly. Now, consumer debt, which you're familiar with, do you have a loan?
Yeah.
On a car? Something? Okay. Now, with consumer loans, they are designed in such a way that you get each payment is the same amount. And every payment, some of it goes to interest and some of it goes to amortize the principal. That is not how corporate and government debt works at all. Corporate and government debt, you pay interest payments only. You service the debt. And then at the end, you make one last interest payment and then you pay what you borrowed back. Isn't that kind of strange? So if I'm the government and I borrow, let's say I give a coupon rate of, let's say, 5%, and I borrow $1 million for 10 years. That would be, let's say, 5 years. On a five-year note, for 5 years, I will pay 5% to the people lending me money. I will pay 5% of that. Did I say $1 million? Okay, 5% of $1 million, which is $50,000. So you've been the lender to the government. You get a check every year for $50,000 for 5 years. At the end of the fifth year, you get one last $50,000 check, and I also send you back your money, your $1 million. That's how government and corporate debt works. Fundamentally different from how consumer debt works is that, now obviously the lenders are going to want you to put money aside every year some way so that you can pay off that $1 million at the end. That'll be part of the lending agreement. But you're, for all intents and purposes, all you do for government and corporate debt is you're paying the coupon, the interest. You're servicing the debt, and then you retire the debt at the end. Now, for the purposes of this course, and hear me well on this,
in the world of finance, unless I say differently, the face value of debt is $1,000. In other words, you will receive $1,000 back. This is the word of the of Professor C.
Always $1,000 is your face value, unless we say it differently. Everything in borrowing corporate and government is in $1,000 increments. So we say the face value, what will be paid back at the end of the life of the debt instrument, is going to be $1,000. Okay? Just remember that. And don't ask about it. As a matter of fact, one of my questions on a quiz, maybe this one or maybe one, which one of the following parameters do you know without having to be told? The coupon rate, the time of maturity, the amount of the debt, or the face value? It's the face value. It's always $1,000. ''50 years from now, you're going to be walking along one of these bad streets. You're old and you're broken down. You hear noise behind you. It's footsteps. And they're getting closer and they're getting closer to you. And you realize you're trapped. You're going down an alley, and these footsteps are getting closer and closer. And you get to the wall, and you can't go anywhere. You turn around, and it's your worst fear. It's the South Side of Chicago finance gang. They hold you up to the wall, and they say, listen, what is the face value of a debt instrument? And you remember back to this moment, and you say, $1,000. And they walk back off you and they say, you're down with us, homie. Are we okay? Anyway, where the hell was I? Okay. Now, there is one other. Now, with the government, and this is actually true with corporations, sometimes there's not a coupon, an interest rate attached directly. Sometimes they will issue these very short instruments, debt instruments, and all they do is they say, you pay us back $1,000 in a year. Those are called discount bills. Okay? Those are called discount bills. In other words, you buy it for something less than $1,000, and then in a year, you get $1,000 back. So basically, your interest is whatever the delta is, the difference is between what you paid for and what you got for, and $1,000 you got back. Now, those are actually very common in some kinds of environments. And the government borrows money on all kinds of different instruments. Sometimes they issue bills. In other words, things that are like 3 months to a year long. Other times, they'll issue notes. In other words, debt debt instruments. They're borrowing money. Notice, by the way, when you're the borrower, you are the issuer of the debt. As the lender, you are the buyer of the debt. So when you buy that nice trailer that you were dreaming of, you are actually the issuer of the mortgage loan, and the bank is the buyer for the purchase price of your loan. That's how it takes a while to get used to that, but that's how it works. Follow with me, though. Okay, so treasury auctions usually have a variety of instruments. Some short stuff, the treasury bills, T-bills. Some longer stuff, 1 to 7 years. Those are notes. And then some very long stuff, 20 to 30 years, those are bonds. And the way it used to work, treasury auction, literally there was a table with all these different instruments, and very wealthy, powerful interests would come and buy them. That was lending the government money. Now they do it by electronics. But what we're going to do now is we're going to go back to the old school. We're going to have a treasury auction where all we have are one-year treasury bills on a table. And you, woman, are going to be the buyer. I am the cashier at the treasury auction. My name is Madge. And Madge is the lady who takes care of the buyers. Well, how are you doing there, young lady? You looking for something in a treasury bill? Well, we've got some very nice ones over here on display. We've got some right here and right here. And, of course, there are a lot of people vying for these. Now, remember, you'll get $1,000 back in 1 year. So, you know, what are you going to pay for it right now? What kind of a price would you like to offer me for this? Come on, lady. Come on. Cat got your tongue? Oh, you're saying maybe $975? Well, that's nice. $975. Yes. Earl! One treasury bill, put it in a bag, drag it through the garden. So the price that you offered and I accepted for that treasury bill was $975. What did I say you're going to get back in 1 year? $1,000. So, how much in dollar interest did you make in 1 year? $25. So I want you to talk to me right now about the yield on that instrument. How much did you say I made in dollars on this? That's not hard. Just say 25. Be confident. 25, man. Can't you see that? You say that to me. 25. No, very good. Very good. 25. And how much did you invest? Yes. If you put $1,000 in that denominator, I promise you I will have that wrong answer as one of the multiple choice answers. I promise you, okay? If you put $1,000 down there in the denominator instead of 975, not only will you get the problem wrong, but I will hunt you down and beat you with a rake. Now, I want you to tell me, what's 25 divided by 975? That's not hard to do, folks. I've even got it on my cell phone. What the heck? Get off me with that. Why did it ask me that? That was a weird thing. Okay. Can you do it? I promise you, you really want to know how to do this. Okay. 25 divided by 975. Survey says? What do you say? No. That's after you have made it a percentage. Give it to me for 4. Because it will be 2 when it's a percentage. It will be 0.02564. Okay, good. Now we're working. And rounded to 2 decimal places as a percentage, That's 2.56%. Okay, that's very nice. Good. Okay. Well, you got your $1,000 back. You're happy. And I'm there, and you show up at the next year's Treasury auction. Well, there you are again. My goodness. I'm so glad you came back. You were satisfied with your last purchase and all that. Oh, you're such a good investor. My goodness, you're such a nice young lady. I have a son. He just got out of prison, but it wasn't really his fault. He was taken astray by that lady and her satanic cult. He didn't kill any of the people, but, I mean, he's available now. Would you like to be? Oh, I'm sorry. You wanted to buy a treasury instrument. Okay, you want to pay $975 again? And you say, hold it there, you old bag. I'm looking around this room and I don't see as many people here wanting these this time. So what are you going to offer me this time?
$950.
Yes, you see, because as the demand goes down, the price is going to go down. The supply stayed the same, but the demand went down, just like classic economics. If the demand for something goes down, its price goes down, right? You know, sooner or later, the demand will go down for the music of assholes like Kanye West, and so he will be at concerts where he'll charge $10 for people to watch his nonsense. So goes to $950. Now, what did you say the face value was? I love it when you talk like that. No, that wasn't creepy. So, madam, how much interest, when you get your $1,000 back, how much dollar interest did you get? You are good. She's good. So now we're going to do the yield on this guy. I don't know why it's a guy. It just seems like. 50 divided by what? 950. So what do you get for the answer? 50? I don't trust you. I'm doing it myself. 0.05263, which is 5.26%. Oh, wait a minute. When the price went down, the yield went up. Second major principle of finance. All other factors being held constant, price going down means yield is going up. When price goes down, yield goes up. All other factors being held constant. One of the most fundamental relationships. And that means that as the yield is going up, the risk of the instrument is going up because interest is a measure of risk. You pay less, so you're taking more risk. You go to Aldi's, you could get cramps. You understand why. Real examples for real people.
Write that down my notes. Aldi's equals cramps.
But here's the last thing I want to share with you very quickly here. I have this dollar. Where the hell? Did someone take? Oh. I want you to do me a favor. What do you see at the top? The dollar bill? What is at the top there?
Federal Reserve note.
Note! What's a note?
Bond?
It's like a bond, except it's a debt instrument. This is a debt instrument. The government, and it's a note, so it will survive from 1 to 7 years. Okay, how are they going to pay off? This is Federal Reserve. How is the Federal Reserve going to pay off this debt instrument? Do you know how it's done? They print another one. That's how our economic system works. Borrow money and then print more to pay off the old money. That's all I have for you. I thank you.